From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Speaker Series Podcasts. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at cseashawaii.com.
I think it does, because these crimes, you know, it might have been 30 years, but they were still committed, and I think it's important to send out a message to the rest of the world, too, that these things are not allowed to happen.
Yeah. Very interesting. Anybody wants to comment? Let me give you just the concrete example of Doig, the first person who is accused by the Tribune at the moment. When the regime was overthrown, Doig took a false identity and he lived a peaceful life in Cambodia. He worked as a teacher, he had a family, he raised a child. And so what people might say is, what is the sense of sending an old man to prison who has already been reintegrated in the Cambodian society? What could you say, or what would you argue in that context? He already did, so maybe somebody else.
Well, it's a little bit like in the Nazi regime. It's a similar thing, because you need to solve those things for the following generations. Like they said, you can't just if the person's integrated, that's no reason that he doesn't have to find justice for what he did. So I think it's a really good idea. But I don't know why didn't they do that like 20 years earlier?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good question. That's a political problem. So first there was civil war until 1997-1998, and so then during that time it was very difficult to establish a court and to actually deal with Cambodian's problems. And then from 1997 onwards, the United Nations tried, in cooperation with the Cambodian government, to actually establish that international court. But there were a lot of problems that the United Nations faced. For example, there was a time in 2000 or 2002 when the United Nations even decided to break everything up, and because they were convinced that the Cambodian system is actually not able to deal with the crimes, that there is such a high rate of corruption and people are not really willing to try the perpetrators. And that was a very big obstacle to the actual process and establishing such an international criminal court. So you can really say that's a big success that in 2007 that court could finally start its work. Is there anybody from Cambodia here? Yeah, okay, so it might be interesting to hear your opinion on that. Because I heard a lot of Cambodians, some Cambodians arguing that the court's actually quite, it's very costly. It's an estimated $30 to even $60 million needed on a yearly basis to finance the trials. And so a lot of people are saying that we need that money to build houses, schools, or hospitals. So what would you say?
So the question again is,
so do you think it makes sense to have those trials now, which are costly and which come 30 years after the crimes were actually committed?
Yeah, I think personally, I think it's very important to have the trial, because if I was born in Cambodia right after the fall down of the regime of Pol Pot, everything is completely destroyed. Education, infrastructure, everything is destroyed. And I was born in that time, and I don't really know whether Khmer Rouge is right or Khmer Rouge is wrong. By the time we have Khmer Rouge, many people think that the leader of Khmer Rouge is good, and they think it's good, you know, it's kind of like Pol Pot regime. It's a good regime for Cambodian people if they don't kill the people. But instead, many people, there are a lot of controversy that me personally, I don't understand. But of course, if the trials come out, it's going to happen, then it will set some more light to more understanding, to kind of like to really understand what is happening and who is right and who is wrong. So, and also it's kind of like helping to heal the wound of the people, especially the survival from that time. If, for example, let's say if my parents, they were gone through in that regime, and then after the regime fall down, even after her, if what is meant, she doesn't even know, because educated people, well, professional people were killed, and those who survive are illiterate people. Like my mom, she doesn't even know how to read and write. So, but she survived. And I asked her, is it right and wrong? She said, I don't know. So I think for the younger generation like me, trial is very important to really understand what is right and what is wrong, and to bring justice.
Yeah,
and to heal the wound of the survival.
Thank you.
Your impression when you went to the country? Did you feel that people had a need for that trials? And did you discuss with Cambodians about trials?
Well, I went there the summer of 2008. I went to the trial. I got lost. We ended up at this garment factory right across from where the trials were happening. And the people across the street had no idea that it was actually going on. So I just got this feeling that nobody really cared at that time. Mm. But then I went this past summer, and it seemed to have gotten a little bit more, publicity, and there was more people there, but at the same time, it still felt like it didn't seem to have that much of an impact, I would say, yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly true. That's really a problem that the court faces at the moment, right? They're trying to send more and more radio programs, newspapers, etc., just to educate people about the ongoing trials, because many Cambodians don't really know about the trials and what is going on, and that's one of the major objects of the trials. And so if the court can't provide the broader knowledge, then it fails, of course, right? So, just let me give a short summary of some major argument that I put forward, Molly. Important goal of the trial is, as you said, put an end to impunity and also help Cambodia to come to terms with its past. So far, Cambodians really know little about the Khmer Rouge regime, also due to the so-called national reconciliation policy. Victims were never given the chance to actually talk about what they've gone through. Cambodia's actual Prime Minister Hun Sen said, quotation mark, "The country should dig a hole and bury the past." So consequently, perpetrators were granted pardon, and the Khmer Rouge period was, for example, completely left out of school, which is a very, very interesting point, because then the younger generation doesn't have a chance to actually learn about what happened and to talk with their parents, etc. So the trials do not only bring justice to Cambodia, but also support the country, I hope, or we hope, in discovering and dealing with its past. So this should be a prior aim of the trials, of course. So then maybe move on to the second question, if there are no other comments. Why is international participation necessary? This is a very general question, so let's talk about the pros and cons of national and international participation. What do you think could be a problem if the proceedings were not supported by the international community? And think of the opposite model. Can you imagine any difficulties if the trials were conducted outside Cambodia by an international tribunal without any national participation?
I think there would not be any tribunal without international intercession, and I think one of the big and long-ranging problems with international participation in Cambodia is the amount of money that gets spread across the community as international dollars or euros or that kind of thing, so that it creates a false economy.
Yeah.
And this false economy sort of encourages people to want international participation, but they only want it to be defined on their terms, which the international community is not willing to do.
Yeah, right. That's true. For those who don't know, for example, Cambodia has the highest density of NGOs, international support, worldwide. So the country really depends on the international support, which prevents the country a bit from establishing an independent economy, etc. So that's really the burden or the problems with international support. But when it comes to the trials, you already said, maybe there wouldn't even be a trial if it was not organized or extremely supported by the international community, of course. Somebody else wants to comment on that?
Well, I think it's definitely necessary for the international community to get involved. It gives leverage for the trial, and then also I think the presence of the international community there and in the tribunals sort of gives the consciousness to the whole world as well. It brings attention to the international community, and I think that is extremely important, because I do think that the Cambodian people, no matter how much they were blocked from knowing what was happening, eventually they'll be told, that they will know, simply because of this awareness that's looming into the incident.
Just now think of the opposite. What do you example, the trials were conducted outside Cambodia. You know, there, for example, the two ad hoc tribunals I was talking about earlier for Rwanda or the former Yugoslavia, which actually took part outside, took place outside the country. So what do you think? What could be a problem if we had the tribunal for Cambodia in the Netherlands, as usual? Or is it important that those trials are actually conducted in Cambodia?
Definitely. I mean, the bottom line also is, what is this tribunal for? It's probably not only for the justice system, but it's also for the victims and for the families of the victims and for the people of Cambodia. I think that is the essence of this whole process. So to have the court taking place outside of Cambodia wouldn't do them justice, I think. And the essence of this whole thing is, I think, still lay with the victims.
Yeah, we'll have to that point later on too. Yeah, just let me add one thing. Another advantage of a hybrid court is also to promote the idea of the rule of law. As you may have seen in the movie before, Cambodia has a very high rate of corruption so far, and the court system is said to be very weak. So the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is supposed to serve as a kind of role model for future trials and future courts. And so I actually talked to a lot of Cambodian lawyers who said that for them it was a really interesting experience to come to the tribunal where actually the law is applied. And for them it was really an interesting new experience. And what people hope is that they take that experience and start to ask for it in national trials. And yeah, thereby the rule of law will be promoted much more than it's now. Oh. Okay, if there are no further comments, we move on to the last question, I'd say. So what role should victims have in the proceedings? Before we discuss that question, I would like to give you just a very brief introduction to the civil party system. As it was mentioned in the film, the Khmer Rouge Tribunal is the first international criminal court that allows a civil party participation. What does that mean? Victims of the regime have now the possibility to take an active part in the proceedings. They join the trial as a third party and have almost all the rights the accused and the prosecutor enjoy. So they can make submissions, file an appeal, or call witnesses. They also have the right to seek reparations from the court, although that right is clearly restricted to what is called moral and collective reparations, so they can't ask for financial compensation. So, what do you think? We don't have any other questions on the board. What do you think are the advantages of such a form of direct civil parties participation, and what could be the difficulties or the disadvantages? You hear the two civil parties talking about the court. What would you say? Is it very important for them to have the trial? What could be the problems with such a direct form of participation?
Well, I think a problem might be that there are so many thousand victims that everybody could just have a short period of attention. So it's not like everybody could be heard. But it still is important that they feel included. But still, everybody just is able to play a little role in this whole thing.
Actually, you're mentioning the most interesting problematic point. The model of civil party participation has actually proven to be much more difficult than expected at first, because as the regime, as you said, affected, or as we saw in the film too, affected almost the entire population, it is very difficult to say who's a victim and who's not. Nearly everybody was concerned. We learned that 90% lost a family member during the regime. So there have been thousands of applications so far, which constitutes a really significant burden for the administration and is likely to cause serious delays in the proceedings, which is a really big problem. As you may know, the accused for the trials are in their late 70s or early 80s, so there's really a need for a speedy trial. So that's really the biggest problem of civil participation so far. And the court at the moment is trying to find new solutions and alternatives for the civil party model. Because at the moment, it takes a long time to review all the applications, and also with the defense having the possibility to ask questions about the civil parties, if they're really victims, etc. That takes a long time, though, to contest their applications. But on the other hand, you heard them speaking. Do you think it's a good model? Because it's the first time in international criminal law that this system is applied, and there are a lot of people criticizing that system. But still, people working for the civil parties, like I did, and all the lawyers I met, they thought that it's very, very, very necessary for victims to raise their voice in the proceedings. What would you say? just.
I think the idea of raising one's voice in a place that has a civil society with a set an established legal system is certainly workable, but most of the Cambodians that I've spoken with really fear what happens after this is done and all the cameras and all the NGOs and all the foreign government officials and money leave, and they're left again living in these communities with former Khmer Rouge soldiers. Their leaders have direct ties to the Khmer Rouge, Hun Sen in particular. So I think that once everything ends, that this will continue for them, and they're not really sure what the ramifications of that will be.
I think that's really interesting, too, because in your documentary, that's kind of the question where the two victims kind of split. For one, like for the man that was interviewed, it seemed almost cathartic enough for him to go through this process and to see that there was participation of others for the sake of his own children and for the sake of future generations. But for the woman, for Navi, that was interviewed, it almost seemed like she was the one that was really highlighting how problematic this type of process really could be, because there was no way, there is probably no way that anyone can really agree upon right now that it can be equal. I'm not even sure that everybody's working within the same framework of what justice means to all the different victims and to all the different types of victimhoods that were experienced. So I think that's where it really gets interesting when you bring the victims into the proceedings, and then when you try to figure out how to define justice both on an international and national level.
Yeah, also the conception of justice is sometimes very difficult to establish, because you heard what she said. What do you think about her criticism? She was saying that the accused is in a very good health condition, and he doesn't even look like a prisoner. That was what she was reproaching, right? And that's a requirement for a fair trial, of course. There's a presumption of innocence. But it's very difficult to understand for victims that you have to think about Doig, for example, as an innocent man until he's convicted guilty. Because the evidence seems to be so clear that that's a general problem, international law, of course. But for Cambodian people who don't have like a legal background, legal education, that is very hard to understand. And that's also a problem with having victims as a third party. They don't have that legal knowledge. Sometimes it is, of course, difficult for them to understand certain decisions. For example, just recently, they were excluded from certain parts of the proceedings. I still think that decision was wrong, because the proceedings are for the victims. But still, there are legal arguments. But for the victims, it was just an infringement of their rights. They didn't understand why it happened. They couldn't understand the legal reasons for that. And so they felt violated. And they protested, they boycotted the trials, and that was really a big problem. And so that's like the negative point of having victims who are also emotionally involved in the trials as a legal party to the proceedings. Right? But still, right, it's important for them to raise their voice and have the feeling, finally, after 30 years, to be heard. Anybody else wants to comment on that?
I think, just having testimony is really strong, but I don't think it's strong enough, because they pretty much like took out all the evidence, and pretty much just having testimonies of like thousands of people still isn't good enough, and also there's been so long ago that it seems like they don't really have a voice, and they don't feel that they have strong enough, like, you know, they can be strong enough to, like, you know, get their rights back. And I think it's really important to fight for that. But I think it's important for them to look forward in the future too. To, like, you know, they should, like, yeah, do like pretty much like a hybrid of like trying to get back their rights, because they pretty much like robbed their life at that moment. I mean, sucks, but they should, like, you know, move forward too at the same time.
There are a lot of attempts at the moment to find some other solutions besides the civil party participation, because actually, as there are like at the moment 2,000, 3,000 applications, not everybody can really play a role in the proceedings. So people are thinking now to establish or to provide for health care, or to deal with there are a lot of trauma projects where people have the chance to talk about what they experience, and finding other solutions than a procedure, a criminal procedure, to help the people to get over what they experience and move on with their lives finally. As for some people, for example, for Chung Mei, that you saw at the beginning, it was so important to have those trials. He told me that for him, he couldn't sleep before he knew that Doig would be facing a trial. But it was still something that hurt him the whole time. His wife died, his newborn child died during that time. And so it's difficult for people to move on with while having those perpetrators living in your country, living a peaceful life, and you were never held responsible for the act they actually committed. And that's still a big problem, as you may know, that at the moment there are only 5 accused before the tribunal, and the international prosecutor is now conducting investigations towards 5 more accused, but still that's only 5 to 10 people. And as you all know, the Khmer regime affected a whole country, so there are a lot of people that were guilty, that are guilty. And it's, for Cambodian, it's hard, as you said, you live in a small village and you know the people next door, maybe they killed your father or something. And still there's no possibility to try him because the Cambodian government made it very clear that it's restricted, the court is clearly restricted, jurisdiction is restricted to high-ranking perpetrators. But of course the government itself was also a bit fearing some more persecutions, of course. And so yeah, that's also a problem of the trial, of course. But it's better to have 10 people prosecuted than no one. Yeah.
Quick question. I just want to know, like, in terms of aside from highest-ranking people, the question is going to be who killed the people, like, in the local level. If you're talking about, like, if who we really want to know, like, who killed the people, you know, it's kind of like we don't know who's killed whom, you know. That but the high-ranking people are the people like making decision, and which is the person that killed in the prison, very clear. But besides from those 5 people, how do we have any evidence to show that who's killed whom?
Yeah, that's very difficult to say. Actually, nobody's investigating on that. That even international prosecutors are clearly said not to go deeper and not to really, not to even to investigate on that level, because the government really pays attention that it's only conducting investigation on those high-ranking perpetrators. So what the prosecutors are doing at the moment is to find evidence to really prove that the high rankings, like Nguyen Khia or Ieng Sary, that they really knew what was happening. What the accused are putting forward at the moment, everybody except Doig, is that they didn't know. They just wanted to establish that form of agrarian communism because they thought it was a good idea for Cambodia, and they wanted to help the Cambodian people. And what happened on the lower level, that people were killed, that people were starving to death, they just didn't know. And that's a proof that is also very difficult to make, of course. How can you prove that somebody actually knew what happened? It seems obvious, right? That the head of a state or somebody, a minister of foreign affairs, he should know. But that's what that's the problems that the prosecution is facing, of course, at the moment. Because the accused have, some of them have really good lawyers, and they are trying to use every possible way to show that it's all the fault of the little people that worked in the communities and killed them, and the high rankings didn't know about anything.
I have also one question about the reparation. I have a question on reparation. So I think important in order for the people to have some sense of justice being brought to their country, I feel like reparation, I mean giving some concrete reparation could be one way for the court to do that. But as you said, it's also restricted to moral and symbolic repression, yeah? So I was wondering what kind of, I don't know, development has been done at the court on this issue.
Because the civil parties were thinking, what can they ask for? And the law of the court is clearly stated that they can only ask for collective and moral reparations, which excludes explicitly financial reimbursement. So you can never say that the Khmer Rouge destroyed my house, I want to have some compensation for that. That's not possible. So what they can ask for and what they did is they ask for medical care for victims, for the building of hospitals, of better education school, for example, that the government should provide school books that teach about the Khmer Rouge regime. They also ask for memorials to build at very significant places to tell the story, etc. So it's more it's more reparations of a very symbolic character in order to teach the population about what happened. But the biggest problem at the moment is that in the ECCC law, it said that the accused has to pay for it. And all accused at the tribunal proclaimed that they don't have any money. So they're indigent, they can't afford to pay for anything. And that's a problem. Can you think of any kind of reparation that doesn't require at least $5? So that's hard to think about. And now we're very, excited to see what the court is making out of it, because the court asked the civil parties to make some suggestions. We did everything I told you, for example, also the publication of the verdict, etc. But still, it's costly. It costs money, and the civil parties have been asking for long times for the establishment of a trust fund. That could be a trust fund that exists, for example, at the International Criminal Court in The Hague too. It's a trust fund where states can contribute, the Cambodian government could, or even private persons could. And this trust fund could be used to finance the collective and moral reparations. But still, there's no such trust fund. And we really hope that the court will find or will see the need for such a fund, as the court itself proclaims every time, it repeats every time, that the seeking of reparation is the major objective of civil party participation. Which I don't think it is not, but I don't think it is. But they say that reparation is the major aim, and if you can't realize that, what's the point of having civil parties then? So that's really the biggest problem that what you're just saying. It's the biggest problem that civil parties have at the moment, and we'll see what's happening in the next months, because the court has to find. Okay, then I think we've come to the end of our discussion. I would like to thank you all for your participation and a very interesting afternoon. And if you have any further question about the ongoing trials, don't hesitate to write me an email. I'll just check the court's homepage. And thank you very much, and have a wonderful evening.